As we'd expect, fish have water-based receptors in their nasal neurons. Mammals and reptiles have air-based ones. This discovery helps us make sense of the state of affairs in the most primitive fish alive on the planet today, the jawless fish such as lampreys and hagfish. It turns out that these creatures have, unlike more advanced fish and mammals, neither air nor water genes. Rather, their receptors combine both types. The implication is clear. These primitive fish arose before the smelling genes split into two types. Jawless fish reveal another very important point. They have a very small number of odor genes. Bony fish have more, and still more are seen in amphibians and reptiles. The number of odor genes has increased over time, from relatively few in primitive creatures such as jawless fish to the enormous number seen in mammals. We mammals, with over 1,000 of these genes, devote a huge part of our entire genetic apparatus just to smelling. Presumably, the more of these genes an animal has, the more acute its ability to discern different kinds of smells. In this light, our large number of odor genes makes sense. Mammals are highly specialized smelling animals. Just think of what effective trackers dogs can be. But where do all our extra odor genes come from? Did they just pop out of the blue? How this expansion happened seems obvious when we look at the structure of the genes. If you compare the odor genes of a mammal with the handful of odor genes in a jawless fish, the extra genes in mammals are all variations on a theme. They look like copies, albeit modified ones, of the genes in jawless fish. This means that our large number of odor genes arose by many rounds of duplication of the small number of genes present in primitive species. This leads us to a paradox. Humans devote about 3% of our genome to odor genes, just like every other mammal. When geneticists looked at the structure of the human genes in more detail, they found a big surprise. Fully 300 of these 1,000 genes are rendered completely functionless by mutations that have altered their structure beyond repair. Other mammals do use these genes. Why have so many odor genes if so many of them are entirely useless? Dolphins and whales, of all creatures, offer an insight to help us answer this question. Like all mammals, dolphins and whales have hair, breasts, and a three-boned middle ear. Their mammalian history is also recorded in their smelling genes. Lacking fish-like water-specialized genes, cetaceans have mammalian air-specialized genes. The mammalian history of whales and dolphins is even written in the DNA of their odor perception apparatus. But there is an interesting puzzle. Dolphins and whales no longer use their nasal passages to smell. What are these genes doing? The former nasal passage has been modified into a blowhole, which is used in breathing, not in smelling. This has had a remarkable effect on the smelling genes. All of a cetacean's odor genes are present, but not one is functional. What has happened to the smell genes of dolphins and whales also happens in many other species' genes. Mutations crop up in genomes from generation to generation. If a mutation knocks out the function of a gene, the result can be dangerous or even lethal. But what happens if a mutation knocks out the function of a gene that does nothing? There is a lot of mathematical theory that says the obvious. Such mutations will just silently get passed on from generation to generation. This is exactly what appears to have happened in dolphins. Their smell genes are no longer needed, given the blowhole, so the mutations that knocked out their function just accumulate over time. The genes have no use, but they remain present in the DNA as silent records of evolution. But humans do have a sense of smell. So why have so many of our odor genes been knocked out? Yoav Gilad and his colleagues answered this question by comparing genes among different primates. He found that primates that develop color vision tend to have large numbers of knocked-out smell genes. The conclusion is clear. We humans are part of a lineage that has traded smell for sight. We now rely on vision more than on smell, and this is reflected in our genome. In this trade-off, our sense of smell was de-emphasized, and many of our olfactory genes became functionless. We carry a lot of baggage in our noses, or, more precisely, in the DNA that controls our sense of smell. Our hundreds of useless olfactory genes are left over from mammal ancestors who relied more heavily on the sense of smell to survive. In fact, we can take these comparisons deeper still. Like photocopies that lose their fidelity as they are repeatedly copied, our olfactory genes get more dissimilar as we compare ourselves to successively more primitive creatures. Our genes are similar to primates, less similar to other mammals, less similar still to reptiles, amphibians, fishes, and so on. That baggage is a silent witness to our past. Inside our noses is a veritable tree of life. Chapter 9. Vision. Only once in my entire career have I found the eye of a fossil creature. I wasn't in the field on an expedition. I was in the back room of a mineral shop in a small town in northeast China. My colleague Gao Keqin and I were studying the earliest known salamanders, beautiful fossils collected from Chinese rocks about 160 million years old. We had just finished a collecting trip to some sites Gao knew about. The locations were secret, because these salamander fossils have serious monetary value for the farmers who typically find them. What makes them special is that impressions of the soft tissue, such as gills, guts, and the notochord, are often preserved. Private collectors love them because fossils of this quality are exceedingly rare. By the time we ended up at the mineral shop, Gao and I had already collected a number of really beautiful ancient salamanders of our own from his sites. This particular mineral dealer had gotten his hands on one of the best salamander fossils of all time. Gao wanted us to see it and spent the better part of a day trying to work the deal. The whole visit had a terrifically illicit feel. Gao spent several hours smoking cigarettes with the gentleman, speaking and gesturing in Chinese. Clearly, there was some bartering going on, but not knowing Chinese, I had no idea what offers were being put on the table. After lots of head shaking and ultimately a big handshake, I was permitted to go to the back room and look at a fossil on the dealer's desk. It was a stunning sight. The body of a larval salamander, no more than 3 inches long. In it, I could see impressions of the whole animal, all the way down to the little shells it ate as its last meal. And, for the first and only time in my career, I was staring at the eye of an ancient fossil animal. Eyes rarely make it into the fossil record. As we've seen, the best candidates for preservation as fossils are the hard parts of the animals, bones, teeth, and scales. If we want to understand the history of eyes, then we can use an important fact to our advantage. There is a remarkable diversity of organs and tissues that animals use to capture light, from simple photoreceptor organs in invertebrate animals to the compound eyes of various insects and our own camera-type eye. How do we put this variation to use in understanding how our ability to see developed over time? the history of our eyes is a lot like that of a car. Take a Chevy Corvette, for example. We can trace the history of the model as a whole, the Corvette, and the history of each of its parts. The Vette has a history, beginning with its origins in 1953 and continuing through the different model designs each year. The tires used on the Vette also have a history, as does the rubber used in making them. This supplies a great analogy for bodies and organs. Our eyes have a history as organs, but so do eyes' constituent parts, the cells and tissues, and so do the genes that make those parts. Once we identify these multiple layers of history in our organs, we understand that we are simply a mosaic of bits and pieces found in virtually everything else on the planet. Much of the processing of the images we see actually happens inside our brains. The role of the eye is to capture light in a way that it can be carried to the brain for processing as an image. Our eyes, like those of every creature with a skull and backbone, are like little cameras. After light from the outside enters the eye, it is focused on a screen at the back of the eyeball. Light travels through several layers as it traverses this path. First, it passes through the cornea, a thin layer of clear tissue that covers the lens. The amount of light that enters the eye is controlled by a diaphragm called the iris, which dilates and contracts by the action of involuntary muscles. The light then passes through the lens, which, as a camera does, focuses the image. Tiny muscles surround the lens. As these muscles contract, they change the lens's shape, thus focusing images from near and far. A healthy lens is clear and made up of special proteins that give it its distinctive shape and light-gathering properties. These proteins, known as lens crystallins, are exceptionally long-lived, allowing the lens to continue functioning as we age. The screen on which all of the light is projected, the retina, is loaded with blood vessels and light receptors. These light receptors send signals to our brain that we then interpret as images. The retina absorbs the light via sensitive light-gathering cells. There are two types of such cells. One is very sensitive to light, the other less so. The more sensitive cells record only in black and white. The less sensitive cells record in color. If we look around the animal world, we can assess whether animals are specialized for daylight or night by looking at the percentages of each type of light-sensing cell in their eyes. In humans, these cells make up about 70% of all the sensory cells in our body. That is a clear statement about how important vision is to us. Our camera-like eye is common to every creature with a skull, from fish to mammals. In other groups of animals, we find different eyes, ranging from simple patches of cells specialized to detect light, to eyes with compound lenses, such as those found in flies, to primordial versions of our own eye. The key to understanding the history of our eyes is to understand the relationship between the structures that make our camera eye and those that make all the other kinds of eyes. To do this, we will study the molecules that gather light, the tissues we use to see, and the genes that make the whole thing. Light-gathering molecules. The really important work in the light-gathering cells happens inside the molecule that actually collects light. When this molecule absorbs light, it changes shape and breaks up into two parts. One part is derived from vitamin A, the other from a protein known as opsin. When the opsin breaks off, it initiates a chain reaction that leads to a neuron sending an impulse to our brain. We use different opsins to see in black and white and in color. Just as an inkjet printer needs three or four inks to print in color, we need 3 light-gathering molecules to see in color. For black and white vision, we use only 1. These light-gathering molecules change shape in the light, then recharge in the dark and go back to their normal state. The process takes a few minutes. We all know this from personal experience. Go from a bright place into a dark room, and it is virtually impossible to see faint objects. The reason is that the light-gathering molecules need time to recharge. After a few minutes, vision in the dark returns. Despite the stunning variety of photoreceptor organs, every animal uses the same kind of light-capturing molecule to do this job. Insects, humans, clams, and scallops all use opsins. Not only can we trace the history of eyes through differences in the structure of their opsins, but we have good evidence that we can thank bacteria for these molecules in the first place. Essentially, an opsin is a kind of molecule that conveys information from the outside of a cell to the inside. To pull off this feat, it needs to carry a chemical across the membrane that encircles a cell. Opsins use a specialized kind of conductor that takes a series of bends and loops as it travels from the outside to the inside of the cell. But this twisted path the receptor takes through the cell membrane is not random. It has a characteristic signature. Where else is this twisted path seen? It is identical to parts of certain molecules in bacteria. The very precise molecular similarities in this molecule suggest a very ancient property of all animals, extending all the way to our shared history with bacteria. In a sense, modified bits of ancient bacteria lie inside our retinas, helping us to see. We can even trace some major events in the history of our eyes by examining opsins in different animals. Take one of the major events in our primate past, the development of rich color vision. Recall that humans and our closest ape relatives, the Old World monkeys, have a very detailed kind of color vision that relies on 3 different kinds of light receptors. Each of these receptors is tuned to a different kind of light. Most other mammals have only 2 kinds of receptors, and so cannot discriminate as many colors as we can. It turns out that we can trace the origin of our color vision by looking at the genes that make the receptors. The 2 kinds of receptors most mammals have are made by 2 kinds of genes. Of our 3 receptor-making genes, 2 are remarkably like one of those in other mammals. This seems to imply that our color vision began when one of the genes in other mammals duplicated, and the copies specialized over time for different light sources. As you'll remember, a similar thing happened with odor receptor genes. This shift may be related to changes in the flora of the Earth millions of years ago. It helps to think what color vision was likely good for when it first appeared. Monkeys that live in trees would benefit because color vision enabled them to discriminate better among many kinds of fruits and leaves and select the most nutritious among them. From studying the other primates that have color vision, we can estimate that our kind of color vision arose about 55 million years ago. At this time, we find fossil evidence of changes in the composition of ancient forests. Before this time, the forests were rich in figs and palms, which are tasty, but all of the same general color. Later, forests had more of a diversity of plants, likely with different colors. It seems a good bet that the switch to color vision correlates with a switch from a monochromatic forest to one with a richer palette of colors in food. Tissues. Animal eyes come in 2 flavors. One is seen in invertebrates, the other in vertebrates, such as fish and humans. The central idea is that there are 2 different ways of increasing the light-gathering surface area in eye tissue. Invertebrates, such as flies and worms, accomplish this by having numerous folds in the tissue, while our lineage expands the surface area by having lots of little projections extending from the tissue, like tiny bristles. A host of other differences also relate to these different kinds of designs. Lacking fossils at the relevant phase of history, it would seem that we would never be able to bridge the differences between our eyes and those of invertebrates. That is, until 2001, when Detlev Arendt thought to study the eyes of a very primitive little worm. Polychaetes are among the most primitive living worms known. They have a very simple segmented body plan, and they also have two kinds of light-sensing organs, an eye and, buried under their skin, a part of their nervous system that is specialized to pick up light. Arendt took these worms apart, both physically and genetically. Knowledge of the gene sequence of our opsin genes and the structure of our light-gathering neurons gave Arendt the tools to study how polychaetes are made. He found that they had elements of both kinds of animal photoreceptors. The normal eye was made up of neurons and opsins like the eye of any invertebrate. The tiny photoreceptors under the skin were another matter altogether. They had vertebrate opsins and cellular structure even with the little bristle-like projections, but in primitive form. Arendt had found a living bridge, an animal with both kinds of eyes, one of which, our kind, existed in a very primitive form. When we look to primitive invertebrates, we find that the different kinds of animal eyes share common parts. Genes. Arendt's discovery leads to yet another question. It is one thing for eyes to share common parts, but how can eyes that look so different, such as those of worms, flies, and mice, be closely related? For the answer, let us consider the genetic recipe that builds eyes. At the turn of the 20th century, Mildred Hoag was recording mutations in fruit flies when she found a fly that had no eyes whatsoever. This mutant was not an isolated case, and Hoag discovered that she could breed a whole line of such flies, which she named eyeless. Later, a similar mutation was discovered in mice. Some individuals had small eyes. Others lacked whole portions of the head and face, including their eyes. A similar condition in humans is known as aniridia. Affected individuals are missing large pieces of their eyes. In these very different creatures, flies, mice, and humans, geneticists were finding similar kinds of mutants. A breakthrough came in the early 1990s when laboratories applied new molecular techniques to understand how eyeless mutants affected eye development. Mapping the genes, they were able to localize the bits of DNA responsible for the mutations. When the DNA was sequenced, it turned out that the fly, mouse, and human genes responsible for eyelessness had similar DNA structures and sequences. In a very real sense, they are the same gene. What did we learn from this? Scientists had identified a single gene that, when mutated, produced creatures with small eyes or no eyes at all. This meant that the normal version of the gene was a major trigger for the formation of eyes. Now came the chance to do experiments to ask a whole other kind of question. What happens when we mess with the gene, turning it on and off in the wrong places? Flies were an ideal subject for this work. During the 1980s, a number of very powerful genetic tools were developed through work on flies. If you knew a gene or a DNA sequence, you could make a fly lacking the gene, or, the reverse, a fly with the gene active in the wrong places. Using these tools, Walter Gehring started playing around with the eyeless gene. Gehring's team was able to make the eyeless DNA active pretty much anywhere they wanted. In the antenna, on the legs, on the wings. When his team did this, they found something stunning. If they turned on the eyeless gene in the antenna, an eye grew there. If they turned on the eyeless gene on a body segment, an eye developed there. Everywhere they turned on the gene, they would get a new eye. To top it all off, some of the misplaced eyes showed a nascent ability to respond to light. Gehring had uncovered a major trigger in the formation of eyes. Gehring didn't stop there. He began swapping genes between species. They took the mouse equivalent of eyeless, PAC6, and turned it on in a fly. The mouse gene produced a new eye. And not just any eye, a fly eye. Gehring's lab found that they could use the mouse gene to trigger the formation of an extra fly eye anywhere. On the back, on a wing, near the mouth. What Gehring had found was a master switch for eye development that was virtually the same in a mouse and a fly. This gene, PAX6, initiated a complex chain reaction of gene activity that ultimately led to a new fly eye. We now know that eyeless, or PAX6, controls development in everything that has eyes. The eyes may look different, some with a lens, some without, some compound, some simple, but the genetic switches that make them are the same. When you look into eyes, forget about romance, creation, and the windows into the soul. With their molecules, genes, and tissues derived from microbes, jellyfish, worms, and flies, you see an entire menagerie. Chapter 10. Ears. The first time you see the inside of the ear is a letdown. The real machinery is hidden deep inside the skull, encased in a wall of bone. Once you open the skull and remove the brain, you need to chip with a chisel to remove that wall. If you're really good, or very lucky, you'll make the right stroke and see it. The inner ear. It resembles the kind of tiny coiled snail shell you find in the dirt in your lawn. The ear may not look like much, but it is a wonderful Rube Goldberg contraption. When we hear, sound waves are funneled into the outside flap, the external ear. The sound waves enter the ear and make the eardrum rattle. The eardrum is attached to three little bones, which shake along with it. One of these ear bones is attached to the snail shell structure by a kind of plunger. The shaking of the ear bone causes the plunger to go up and down. This causes some gel inside the snail shell to move around. Swishing gel bends nerves, which send a signal to the brain, which interprets it as sound. Next time you are at a concert, just imagine all the stuff flying around in your head. This structure allows us to distinguish three parts to the ear: external, middle, and inner. The external ear is the visible part. The middle contains the little ear bones. Finally, the inner ear consists of the nerves, the gel, and the tissues that surround them. These three components of ears enable us to structure our discussion in a very convenient way. The part of the ear we can see, the flap on which we hang our glasses, is a relatively new evolutionary addition to bodies. Confirm this on your next trip to the aquarium or zoo. How many sharks, bony fish, amphibians, and reptiles have external ears? The pinna, the flap of the external ear, is found only in mammals. Some amphibians and reptiles have visible external ears, but they have no pinna. Often the external ear is only a membrane that looks like the top of a drum. The elegance of our connection to sharks and bony fish is revealed when we look inside our ears. Ears might seem an unlikely place for a human-shark connection, especially since sharks don't have ears. But the connection is there. Let's start with the ear bones. The middle ear, the three ear bones. Mammals are very special. With hair and milk-producing glands, we can easily be distinguished from other creatures. It surprises most people to learn that some of the most distinctive traits of mammals lie inside the ear. The bones of the mammalian middle ear are like those of no other animal. Mammals have three bones, whereas reptiles and amphibians have only one. Fish have none at all. Where did our middle ear bones come from? Some anatomy. Recall that our three middle ear bones are known as the malleus, incus, and stapes. As we've seen, each of these ear bones is derived from the gill arches, the stapes from the first arch, and the malleus and incus from the second arch. It is here that our story begins. In 1837, the German anatomist Karl Reichert was looking at embryos of mammals and reptiles to understand how the skull forms. He followed the gill arches of different species to understand where they ended up in the various skulls. As he did this again and again, he found something that appeared not to make any sense. Two of the ear bones in the mammals corresponded to pieces of the jaw in the reptiles. Reichert could not believe his eyes, and his monograph reveals his excitement. As he describes the ear-jaw comparison, his prose departs from the normally staid description of 19th-century anatomy to express shock, even wonderment, at this discovery. The conclusion was inescapable. The same gill arch that formed part of the jaw of a reptile formed ear bones in mammals. Reichert proposed a notion that even he could barely believe, that parts of the ears of mammals are the same thing as the jaws of reptiles. Things get more difficult when we realize that Reichert proposed this several decades before Darwin propounded his notion of a family tree for life. What does it mean to call structures in two different species the same without a notion of evolution? Much later, in 1910 and 1912, the German anatomist Ernst Gaup picked up on Reichert's work and published an exhaustive study on the embryology of mammalian ears. Gaup provided more detail and, given the times, interpreted Reichert's work in an evolutionary framework. Gaup's story went like this. The three middle ear bones reveal the tie between reptiles and mammals. The single bone in the reptilian middle ear is the same as the stapes of mammals. Both are second arch derivatives. The explosive bit of information, though, was that the two other middle ear bones of mammals, the malleus and the incus, evolved from bones set in the back of the reptilian jaw. If this was indeed the case, then the fossil record should show bones shifting from the jaw to the ear during the origin of mammals. The problem was that Gaup worked only on living creatures and didn't fully appreciate the role that fossils could play in his theory. Beginning in the 1840s, a number of new kinds of fossil creatures were becoming known from discoveries in South Africa and Russia. Often abundantly preserved, whole skeletons of dog-sized animals were being unearthed. As they were discovered, many of them were crated and shipped to Richard Owen in London for identification and analysis. Owen was struck that these creatures had a melange of features. Parts of their skeleton looked reptile-like. Other parts, notably their teeth, looked like mammals. And these were not isolated finds. It turns out that these mammal-like reptiles were the most common skeletons being uncovered at many fossil sites. Not only were they very common, there were many kinds. In the years after Owen, these mammal-like reptiles became known from other parts of the world and from several different time periods in Earth history. They formed a beautiful transitional series in the fossil record between reptile and mammal. Until 1913, embryologists and paleontologists were working in isolation from one another. At this time, the American paleontologist W.K. Gregory of the American Museum of Natural History, saw an important link between Gaup's embryos and the African fossils. The most reptilian of the mammal-like reptiles had only a single bone in its middle ear. Like other reptiles, it had a jaw composed of many bones. Something remarkable was revealed as Gregory looked at the successively more mammalian mammal-like reptiles, something that would have floored Reichert had he been alive. A continuum of forms, showing beyond doubt that over time the bones at the back of the reptilian jaw got smaller and smaller, until they ultimately lay in the middle ear of mammals. The malleus and incus did indeed evolve from jawbones. What Reichert and Gaup observed in embryos was buried in the fossil record all along, just waiting to be discovered. Why would mammals need a three-boned middle ear? This little linkage forms a lever system that allows mammals to hear higher frequency sounds than animals with a single middle ear bone. The origin of mammals involved not only new patterns of chewing, as we saw in Chapter 4, but new ways of hearing. In fact, this shift was accomplished not by evolving new bones, per se, but by repurposing existing ones. Bones originally used by reptiles to chew evolved in mammals to assist in hearing. So much for the malleus and incus. Where, though, does the stapes come from? If I simply showed you an adult human and a shark, you would never guess that this tiny bone deep inside a human's ear is the same thing as a large rod in the upper jaw of a fish. Yet, developmentally, these bones are the same thing. The stapes is a second arch bone, as is the corresponding bone in a shark and a fish, the hyomandibula. But the hyomandibula is not an ear bone. Recall that fish and sharks do not have ears. In our aquatic cousins, this bone is a large rod that connects the upper jaw to the brain case. Despite the apparent differences in the function and shape of these bones, the similarities between the hyomandibula and the stapes extend even to the nerves that supply them. The key nerve for the functioning of both bones is the second arch nerve, the facial nerve. We thus have a situation where two very different bones have similar developmental origins and patterns of innervation. Is there an explanation for this? Again, we look to the fossils. As we trace the hyomandibula from sharks to creatures like Tiktaalik to amphibians, we can see how it gets smaller and smaller, ultimately shifting position from the upper jaw to play a role in hearing. The name changes too. When it is big and supporting the jaw, we call it a hyomandibula. When it is small and functions in hearing, it is known as a stapes. This shift happened when the descendants of fish began to walk on land. Hearing in water is different from hearing on land, and the small size and position of the stapes makes it ideal for picking up vibrations in air. The new ability came about by modifying the upper jawbone of a fish. Our middle ear contains a record of two of the great transformations in the history of life. The origin of our stapes and its transformation from a jaw support bone to an ear bone began when fish started to walk on land. The other big event took place during the origin of mammals, when bones at the back of a reptile jaw became our malleus and incus. Now, let's go further inside the ear, to the inner ear. The inner ear, gels moving and hairs bending. Move through the external ear, go deeper inside, past the eardrum and three middle ear bones, and you end up deep inside the skull. Here you will find the inner ear, tubes and some gel-filled sacs. In humans, as in other mammals, The bony tubes take the snail shell shape that is so strikingly apparent in the anatomy lab. The inner ear has different parts dedicated to different functions. One part is used in hearing, another in telling us which way our head is tilted, and still another in recording how fast our head is accelerating or stopping. In carrying out each of these functions, the inner ear works in roughly the same way. The several parts of the inner ear are filled with a gel that can move. Specialized nerve cells send hair-like projections into this gel. When the gel moves, the hairs on the ends of the nerve cells bend. When these hairs bend, the nerve cells send an electrical impulse to the brain, where it is recorded as sound, position, or acceleration. To envision the structure that tells us where our head is in space, imagine a Statue of Liberty snow globe. The snow globe is made of plastic and filled with gel. When you shake it, the gel moves and the snow falls on Lady Liberty. Now, imagine a snow globe made of a flexible membrane. Pick it up and tilt it, and the whole thing will flop about, causing the gel inside to swish around. This, on a much smaller scale, is what we have inside our ears. When we bend our heads, these contraptions flop around, causing the usual chain of events. The gel inside swishes, the hair projections on the nerves bend, and an impulse is sent back to our brains. In us, this whole system is made even more sensitive by the presence of tiny rock-like structures on top of the membrane. As we bend our heads, the rocks accentuate the flopping of the membrane, causing the gel to move even more. This increases the sensitivity of the system, enabling us to perceive small differences in position. Tilt your head, and little rocks inside your skull move. You can probably imagine how tough it would be to live in outer space. Our sensors are tuned to work in the Earth's gravity, not in a gravity-free space capsule. Floating around, our eyes recording one version of up and down, our inner ear sensors totally confused, it is all too easy to get sick. Space sickness has been a real problem for these very reasons. The way we perceive acceleration is based on yet another part of our inner ear, connected to the previous two. There are three gel-filled tubes inside the ear. Each time we accelerate or stop, the gel inside the tubes moves, causing the nerve cells to bend and stimulate a current. The whole system we use to perceive position and acceleration is connected to our eye muscles. The motion of our eyes is controlled by 8 small muscles attached to the side walls of the eyeball. The muscles contract to move the eye up, down, left, and right. We can move our eyes voluntarily by contracting these muscles each time we decide to look in a new direction. But some of the most fascinating properties of these muscles relate to their involuntary action. They move our eyes all the time, without our even thinking about it. To appreciate the sensitivity of this eye-muscle link, move your head back and forth while looking at the page. Keep your eyes fixed in one place as you move your head. What happened during this experiment? Your eyes stayed fixed on a single point while your head moved. This motion is so commonplace that we take it for granted, but it is incredibly complex. Each of the 8 muscles in both eyes is responding to the movement of the head. Sensors in your head, which I'll describe in the next section, record the direction and velocity of your head's movement. These signals are carried to the brain, which then sends out signals telling your eye muscles to fire. Think about that the next time you fix your gaze as your head is moving. This system can misfire, and misfires have much to tell us about our general well-being. An easy way to understand the inner ear-eye connection is to interfere with it. One way humans do this is to imbibe too much alcohol. Drinking too much ethanol leads us to do silly things because our inhibitions are lowered. Drinking way too much gives us the spins. And the spins often predict a lousy morning ahead, hungover, with more spins, nausea, and headache. When we drink too much, we are putting lots of ethanol into our bloodstream, but the fluid inside our ear tubes initially contains very little. As time passes, however, the alcohol diffuses from our blood into the gel of the inner ear. Alcohol is lighter than the gel, so the result of the diffusion is like the result of pouring alcohol into a glass of olive oil. Just as the oil moves around in the glass as the alcohol enters, so the gel inside our ear swirls. The convection wreaks havoc on the intemperate among us. Our hair cells are stimulated and our brain thinks we are moving, but we are not moving. We are slumped in a corner or hunched on a bar stool. Our brain has been tricked. The problem extends to our eyes. Our brain thinks we are spinning, and it passes this information to our eye muscles. The eyes twitch in one direction, usually to the right, as we try to track an object moving from side to side. If you prop open the eyes of someone who is stone drunk, you might see this stereotypical twitch, called nystagmus. Police know this well, and often look for nystagmus in people whom they have stopped for driving erratically. Massive hangovers involve a slightly different response. The day after the binge, your liver has done a remarkably efficient job of removing the alcohol from your bloodstream. Too efficient, for we still have alcohol in the tubes in our ears. That alcohol then diffuses from the gel back into the bloodstream, and in doing so, it once more sets the gel in motion, the spins again. Take the same heavy drinker whose eyes you saw twitch to the right the night before, and look at him during the hangover. His eyes might still twitch, but in the opposite direction. We can thank our shared history with sharks and fish for this. If you have ever tried to catch a trout, then you have come up against an organ that is likely an antecedent to our inner ear. As every fisherman knows, trout hold only in certain parts of a stream, typically spots where they can get the best meal while avoiding predators. Often such places are in the shade and in the eddies of the stream's current. Great places for big fish to hold are behind big rocks or fallen logs. Trout, like all fish, have a mechanism that allows them to sense the current and the motion of the water around them, almost like a sense of touch. Within the skin and bones of the fish, arranged in lines that run the length of the body and head, are small organs with sensory receptors. These receptors lie in small bundles from which they send small hair-like projections into a jelly-filled sac called a neuromast organ. It helps to think of the snow globe Statue of Liberty again. A neuromast organ is like a tiny one of these, with nerves projecting inside. When the water flows around the fish, it deforms this small sac, thereby bending the hair-like projections of the nerve. Much like the whole system in our ears, this apparatus then sends a signal back to the brain and gives the fish a sense of what the water is doing around them. Sharks and fish can discern the direction in which the water is flowing, and some sharks can even detect distortions of the water, such as are produced by other fish swimming near them. We used a version of this system when we moved our head with a fixed gaze, and we saw it go awry when we propped open the eyes of the inebriated individual at the start of this section. If the ancestor we have in common with sharks and fish had used some other kind of inner ear gel, say one that does not swirl when alcohol is added, we would never spin when drunk. If you think of our inner ears and neuromast organs as versions of the same thing, you would not be far off. Both come from the same sort of tissue during development, and they share a similar structure. But which came first, neuromasts or inner ears? Here, the evidence gets sketchy. If you look at some of the earliest fossils with heads, creatures about 500 million years old, you'll find little pits in their external armor that suggest they had neuromast organs. Unfortunately, we do not know much about the inner ears of these creatures because the preservation of that area of the head is wanting. Until more evidence rolls in, we are left with one of two alternatives. Either our inner ears arose from neuromast organs, or the other way around. Both scenarios, at their core, reflect a principle we've seen at work in other parts of the body. Organs can come about for one function, only to be repurposed over time for any number of new uses. In our own ears, there occurred an expansion of the inner ear. The part of our inner ear devoted to hearing is, as in other mammals, huge and coiled. More primitive creatures, such as amphibians and reptiles, have a simple, uncoiled inner ear. Clearly, our mammalian forebears obtained a new and better type of hearing. The same is true for the structures that perceive acceleration. We have three canals to record acceleration because we perceive space in three dimensions. The earliest known fish with these canals, a kind of jawless fish like a hagfish, has only one. Then, in other primitive fish, we see two. Finally, most modern fish and other vertebrates have three, like us. We have seen that our inner ear has a history that can be traced to the earliest fish. Remarkably, the neurons inside the gel of our ears have an even more ancient history. These neurons, called hair cells, have special features that are seen in no other neuron. With fine, hair-like projections consisting of one long hair and a series of smaller ones, these neurons lie with a fixed orientation in our inner ear and in a fish's neuromast organ. Recently, people have searched for these cells in other creatures and have found them not only in animals that do not have sense organs like ours at all, but also in animals that have no heads. They are seen in creatures like Amphioxus, which we met in Chapter 5, that have no ears, eyes, heads, or skulls. Hair cells, then, were around doing other things before our sense organs even hit the scene. All this is recorded in our genes, of course. If humans or mice have a mutation that knocks out a gene called PAX2, the inner ear fails to form properly. PAX2 is active in the ear region and appears to start a chain reaction of gene activity that leads to the development of the inner ear. Go fishing for this gene in more primitive animals, and we find PAX2 active in the head, and, lo and behold, in the neuromasts. The spinning drunk and the fish's water-sensing organs have common genes, evidence of a common history. Jellyfish and the origins of eyes and ears. Just like PAX6, which we discussed earlier in connection with eyes, PAX2 in ears is a major gene, essential for proper development. Interestingly, a link between PAX2 and PAX6 suggests that ears and eyes might have had a very ancient common history. This is where the box jellyfish enters our story. Well known to swimmers in Australia because they have particularly poisonous venom, these jellyfish are different from most others in that they have eyes, more than 20 of them. Most of these eyes are simple pits spread over the jellyfish's epidermis. Other eyes on the body are strikingly similar to our own, with a kind of cornea, a lens, even a nervous structure like ours. Jellyfish do not have either PAX6 or PAX2. They arose before those genes hit the scene. But in the box jellyfish's genes, we see something remarkable. the gene that forms the eyes is not PAX6, as we'd expect, but a sort of mosaic that has the structure of both PAX6 and PAX2. In other words, this gene looks like a primitive version of other animals' PAX6 and PAX2. The major genes that control our eye and ear correspond to a single gene in more primitive creatures, such as jellyfish. You're probably thinking, so what? The ancient connection between ear and eye genes helps to make sense of things we see in hospital clinics today. A number of human birth defects affect both the eyes and the inner ear. All this is a reflection of our deep connections to primitive creatures like the stinging box jellyfish. Chapter 11. The Meaning of It All. The Zoo in You. My professional introduction to academia happened in the early 1980s, during my college years, when I volunteered at the American Museum of Natural History in New York City. Aside from the excitement of working behind the scenes in the collections of the museum, one of the most memorable experiences was attending their raucous weekly seminars. Each week, a speaker would come to present some esoteric study on natural history. Following the presentation, often a fairly low-key affair, the listeners would pick the talk apart, point by point. It was merciless. On occasion, the whole thing felt like a human barbecue, with the invited speaker as the spit-roasted main course. Frequently, these debates would devolve into shouting sessions with all the high dudgeon and operatic pantomime of an old silent movie, complete with shaken fists and stomped feet. Here I was, in the hallowed halls of academe, listening to seminars on taxonomy. You know, taxonomy, the science of naming species and organizing them into the classification scheme that we all memorized in introductory biology. I could not imagine a topic less relevant to everyday life, let alone one less likely to lead eminent senior scientists into apoplexy and the loss of much of their human dignity. The injunction, "Get a life," could not have seemed more apt. The irony is that I now see why they got so worked up. I didn't appreciate it at the time, but they were debating one of the most important concepts in all of biology. It may not seem earth-shattering, but this concept lies at the root of how we compare different creatures, a human with a fish, or a fish with a worm, or anything with anything else. It has led us to develop techniques that allow us to trace our family lineages, identify criminals by means of DNA evidence, understand how the AIDS virus became dangerous, and even track the spread of flu viruses throughout the world. The concept I'm about to discuss supplies the underpinning for much of the logic of this book. Once we grasp it, we see the meaning of the fish, worms, and bacteria that lie inside of us. The articulation of truly great ideas, of the laws of nature, begins with simple premises that all of us see every day. From simple beginnings, ideas like these extend to explain the really big stuff, like the movement of the stars or the workings of time. In that spirit, I can share with you one true law that all of us can agree upon. This law is so profound that most of us take it completely for granted. Yet it is the starting point for almost everything we do in paleontology, developmental biology, and genetics. This biological law of everything is that every living thing on the planet had parents. Every person you've ever known has biological parents, as does every bird, salamander, or shark you have ever seen. Technology may change this, thanks to cloning or some yet-to-be-invented method, but so far, the law holds. To put it in a more precise form, every living thing sprang from some parental genetic information. This formulation defines parenthood in a way that gets to the actual biological mechanism of heredity and allows us